Hi everyone, and a warm welcome to this episode in a series of webinars in collaboration between ISCOS and WealthSpect. My name is Ami Kivi, and I work at WealthSpect as the Global Product Manager for the Female Portfolio. Today, we'll discuss the challenges that many women face throughout their life with bladder and bowel, and we will also deep dive into the consequential effects of our spinal cord injured women. I'm joined today by two very inspiring doctors with quite different specialities, but I think you will learn from our discussions today that there are many aspects that unites their research. I'm glad to introduce Maria J. Hagen. You are associate professor at obstetrics and gynecology at Sahlgrenska Academy in Sweden. And we also have Inge Eriks Hogland. You work as a physician at the Swiss Paraplegic Center, and you also teach at the University of Zurich. A very warm welcome to both of you. So let's get started. I think, Maria, why don't you start by just introducing your work and your research shortly for us?
Hi, everyone, and thank you for inviting me for this lesson. I work as a general gynecologist, especially urogynecology since many years, and I also do a lot of research mainly on pelvic floor function for women during their lifetime. And I've been especially interested in obstetric events and late complications from pelvic floor. I've especially been interested in different modes of delivery and consequences, and also done mapping on pelvic floor dysfunction in women that haven't had children and women different ages and risk factor.
And what about you, Inge? Would you like to share a few background images?
Yes, of course. And thank you for organizing this webinar. I'm looking forward to it. I'm a medical doctor of physical medicine and rehabilitation since 20 years, and also since 20 years in the field of spinal cord injury. Now currently working at the Swiss Paraplegic Center as head of the outpatient department. And part of my work is also the guideline development of follow-up care, but also pregnancy in women with spinal cord injury, and of course, bladder and bowel management.
Yes, and we'll be hearing more about that later. But I think we'll just get on with it. And Maria, I know you've worked many years as a gynecologist. And as you mentioned, you have done extensive research around pelvic floor disorder with women. How common would you say that these problems are with women in general? And which women would you say are at greater risk?
Women are especially prone to have pelvic floor disorders because of the anatomical differences, for example, in comparison with men. We do have the possibility to stand, walk, and also have children. And that's a reason why we have a much weaker pelvic floor than men have. That means that we are prone to dysfunction when we have trauma to the pelvic floor. And the women who do not have had a trauma, women without childbirth, they do have also a lot of pelvic floor weaknesses. So in general, I think about 20 to 40, 45% of all women have some kind of problem with incontinence, genital prolapse symptoms, or bowel incontinence. So it's very common, and millions of women have problems. We know just about those who seek help for their problems, but that is just the top of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. So women are prone to, with age, and if they add weight, which we do, all women during lifetime, we have a tendency to have pelvic floor dysfunction.
Yes, that's a lot more than I think most doctors know, that this is a very common disorder. I was also thinking, what would you say are the main consequences of incontinence for women?
We do know a lot about this due to qualitative studies, that there is a profound influence on the well-being and quality of life because of accidental urinary and bowel incontinence. it's very common with feelings of shame and a lowered self-esteem. Also, especially bowel incontinence leads to social limitations and isolation. Some also sexual dysfunction. And we think that it affects women in their workplace, when they do sports, and also have economic difficulties due to their pelvic floor dysfunction.
And I know you mentioned it previously also that women tends to have these disorders earlier than men, right? So they have it while they're in their working life, and that's different from women.
Yeah, most men have the problems after the age of 70, while women already in the 25, 30 years, especially after childbirth, can have their debut of incontinence. And we know from several studies that women almost have had their difficulties 5 to 10 years before they tend to seek health care.
That's a long time. And I was thinking also about the variables you were talking of. Would you like to share a little bit about the model that you've been working on and the variables that you've been using in this model?
You mean the
prognostic model, sorry.
The prognostic models.
Yes.
Yes, we have worked a lot of prognostic models, especially for pregnant women, to try to make individual risk assessment. Most of pelvic floor disorders do debut in later midlife. So we have made studies for the risk of having incontinence and genital prolapse symptoms 12 to 20 years after they have their birth. And what we saw in that study was that, of course, weight for the women, heredity factors such as having a primary relative is a risk factor, but also if they have had urinary incontinence or prolapse symptoms during the pregnancy, that is a real strong risk factors for later incontinence, but also worse incontinence than before. We saw also that, of course, big baby, to deliver a big baby, especially if the mother is short, that's a risk factor. And there are several other risk factors that we built in the model.
Very interesting. Inge, would you like to tell us a little bit about the patients that you meet at the paraplegic center? And if you believe that the model that Maria is talking about also could be applied on them, if this is an opportunity for these women as well?
Yes, of course. At the center, we see men and women with spinal cord injury. And of course, bladder and bowel problems due to spinal cord injury are already a problem. And of course, it depends on the level and the completeness of the injury, how bladder and bowel management is influenced. But I could very much imagine that extra factors like giving birth could add to this. So that's very interesting. But in women with spinal cord injury, there is, to my knowledge, no research in this.
I've seen some studies that mainly focus on lacerations during the delivery. And I couldn't find any differences actually between spinal cord injured and not spinal cord injured, and mostly focusing on urinary infection during childbirth.
Which is of course also a problem.
But we know, for example, that nowadays we know from 3 big studies from Australia, from US and from Europe actually, that almost every 5th woman have to do surgery for incontinence or genital prolapse before their age of 80, 85. So it's so common and a real health burden for society, not only for the woman affected.
That's incredibly high numbers. Inge, I was thinking, you mentioned to me on another call that women with spinal cord injuries tend to have less pregnancies. And I know that you also say that there's a higher risk for these women to have vaginal delivery. Would you like to just tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, actually, we also here we know quite little about the differences between sexuals and vaginal births, but we know that women, especially, and I know the numbers from Switzerland, that women with spinal cord injury tend to have less children than non-injured women with spinal cord injury. And then, of course, the question is why? What is perhaps they are afraid? Of course, you have to have a partner or at least the possibility to get pregnant. But there are, of course, many factors that may lead to less pregnancies in women with spinal cord injury. And when you mention the risk as a pregnant woman with spinal cord injury, of course, we have some concerns. It's the increased incidence we know during pregnancy of urinary tract infections, increased risk of pressure sores, increased risk of bowel problems. So the whole management around the pregnancy should be very well organized. That, of course, is not a reason to say women with spinal cord injury shouldn't get pregnant, but there are some things I think you should discuss or at least speak about how to handle these problems once they appear.
Yes, I'm sure that very many spinal cord injury women would like children, of course, as well, but
Yes.
maybe they're afraid of it and put extra burden on their maybe the handicap they already have.
Yes. Especially in women with tetraplegia, of course, that then it's not just the birth, but also the taking care of the children afterwards. It's like discussing the medication, breastfeeding. What do you do once you have a urinary tract infection? How is birth organized, etc., etc.? So it's not per se that pregnancy is a medical problem. But at least you should consider, speak about, and discuss what you should do or what a woman should do once these problems appear. Yeah.
I
How
agree.
something we notice in the obstetrics nowadays is that also women with chronic diseases and injuries like this we are talking about today want children, and we have to follow the sign what we know about the risks, and there are no obvious increased risk with these women. Although I think 50% of all those the women with the spinal cord injuries are having a C-section, but I'm not sure that it's on medical for medical reasons. Maybe there are other reasons behind that.
Yeah, there are sometimes it's practical reasons. Women living in rural areas, for example, here tend to have more chance of a sexual or a planned sexual than women who live nearby the hospital. And of course, it depends also on the level and the completeness of the injury in
Absolutely.
women with tetraplegia. Where we know that autonomic dysregulation is a problem, of course, that's very different than a woman with a paraplegia without any problems like this. So that depends, but not only for medical reason. I think in general, some women prefer asexual and some women don't.
And today, a cesarean section is a very safe surgery. With modern antibiotics and techniques, I would say it's very safe surgery.
Yes, and even knowing this, I knowing it that many spinal cord injured women still like to have a vaginal delivery, even though the risks are higher. Isn't that so?
Well, that also depends, I think, on the level and the completeness of the injury and perhaps also the anatomical changes after a traumatic spinal cord injury. And I think it's our duty as medical doctors to inform our patients on the possible risks. And I know, of course, women with spinal cord injury don't want to be treated differently than women in the general population. And I'm the last to want to put an etiquette on this patient population as a problem, but I think it's wise to discuss and speak about risks because that also gives us a possibility to better manage and handle problems once they appear. And hopefully they don't appear, but sometimes they do, and then we should be prepared, and especially the women with spinal cord injury should be prepared and know what they should do once they appear.
Yeah, being prepared is the key word, isn't it? Maria, do you have anything that you'd like to add to this? Do you have any sort of experience that's similar?
Yeah, I totally agree with Inge that especially women with chronic diseases and pregnancy, very many of them want to be treated as normal as possible because they aren't their diagnosis. Most pregnant women, they are healthy and have never been in contact with healthcare before, but women with chronic diseases or injuries, they have had too much contact with healthcare, and they really long for being just treated as normally as possible. And we know that from studies in women with HIV, that nowadays don't need to have a cesarean section to have a safe birth. They can have a normal vagina delivery. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the studies I think of. But it's very important to listen to women's values and goals regarding the mode of delivery to improve their satisfaction so they mm-hmm. can do a shared decision with our doctors about their delivery. But I will also say that information about pelvic floor, it is inherently weaker in normal without chronic diseases or injuries. So what my special interest is the pelvic floor disorders that is very common after a vaginal birth. Mm-hmm. And we know a lot of the long-term consequences of these injuries due to the birth. And we have to take both perspectives into account. What women with already dysfunction pelvic floor, what it means to them. And we have absolutely no scientific evidence on what will happen to these women. Is it more common with more difficulties after a vaginal birth, or are they unaffected by a vaginal birth? So we need to have more studies on that. And for some women, pelvic floor function may be the most important thing to discuss with our doctors. And today we can't say what will happen if they have a trauma, especially the first birth is a trauma. And we know, for example, here in Scandinavia, and anal sphincter rupture in a woman with already an altered function, that happens in 5 to 10%. And we don't know what will happen to the patients in the long term. We know a bit, we know that about 25% of women with a sphincter rupture in birth will have problems with fecal incontinence 20 years later. So that is something you can have in your basis for information.
When making decisions and recommendations.
Yeah,
I agree. Mm-hmm. Looks like you have more research to do hearing from
yes.
you.
But balanced information to the patient and really know what's important for her. And I think it's important that she makes the decision.
Yeah, you're right. In discussing this, half of the world's population are women. And as you said, Maria, a very high proportion, 25% have some sort of pelvic floor disorders later on in life. And especially bowel problems tends to be very exhausting and very shameful for all these women. Mm-hmm. But we tend not to hear in much about it, neither in the press or social media. There's not much talk about this. Why isn't it?
Yes, it's very hard to tell. But I know from other studies done that a lot of women think that this is part of a normal aging, that you have incontinence, urinary incontinence or bowel incontinence and genital prolapse symptoms. But for some women, especially in Africa, they can't even talk to their husbands or partners about it because that may lead to that the husband leaves them, actually. And there are a lot of shameful factors about this. I'd say urinary incontinence is something that we hear a lot about nowadays, mm-hmm. but the most difficult part is a bowel incontinence. And that is a sad story, actually, because we have so little to surgical treatment to offer these women. So mm-hmm. we can just treat them conservatively with medications. And that is probably due to a traumatic birth earlier in life. But I think the more we talk about them, the younger generation, they do talk about these things, but it's nothing you talk about with your relatives when you have a dinner party or so. It's really hard.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. But I think you should at least talk with your friends, your female friends among women, and with your doctor, of course. As you said, fecal incontinence is such a burden for these women, so it should be really on the top of the agenda.
Absolutely. We know that just the problem with social isolation is especially for women with bowel incontinence because of smelling. They are constantly feared of having accidents.
Do you have anything to comment on this, Inge?
Yeah, that is of course. In spinal cord injury, bladder and bowel management is part of every appointment at the medical doctor. That's a huge problem. It's very hard to handle, especially if you compare it with men with spinal cord injury. There are much better solutions for bladder incontinence, and in women that's more difficult. And fecal incontinence, like you said, Maria, is of course still a topic with a lot of shame, and that's a pity, because it doesn't have to be an operation. There are a lot of conservative medical medications that might help. So it's really important to discuss this. And what I already learned from talking with you, Maria, is that we address this topic, I think, too little in our women with spinal cord injury after childbirth. I think that we can do better and actively address this topic. We don't have any numbers or evidence in how this is in women with spinal cord injury. So it's certainly important. And I
would really be interested in what anal sphincter rupture would do to a spinal cord injured woman.
Yeah, that's of course interesting. If there is some patients with spasticity, and especially spasticity of the anal sphincter, that would be of course very different if there's a rupture of the anal sphincter in this population compared to, for example, women with lumbar and sacral spinal cord injuries like our women with spina bifida. That's of course completely different.
Yes.
But to be honest, we don't have any evidence, no research on this, as far as I know.
Yeah. But still, though, Inge, you have developed guidelines for follow-up care for SCI patients, which I think is really interesting, and hope everyone in this call have read that work with spinal cord injured patients. And there you also have a chapter on bladder and bowel, right? And not particularly perhaps for women that have given childbirth, but you do bring this topic up with each patient during the consultation at the center, right?
Yes, there are several guidelines. We have the guideline for the follow-up care after spinal cord injury that is very structured, and bowel and bladder management is of course a topic in this, but also a gynecological care. And having this guideline makes this that it's easier for also for the junior doctors, but also for the women with spinal cord injury to talk about it. Also the guideline, but also the guideline for pregnancy and bladder and bowel management. They are also, of course, political and strategical tools to set a standard and to show also our patients that it is part, at least in our patient population, of men and women with spinal cord injury. So that's a step to acknowledge that it is a problem, to acknowledge that we actively have to speak about it, but also to health insurances, etc., that further treatment of this problem is part of the treatment of women with spinal cord injury. So guidelines are, in my opinion, an important tool in several layers.
I agree. And this is a very fragile group of people we're talking about as well. In many senses, they have many problems. So I think I've read the guidelines, and I think it's a great tool for doctors to use in their everyday work.
Yeah, it also motivates us really to speak about it, and it gives a structure, and it gives also assessments to make it more objective, to really address the problem and scale it with, for example, a Bristol stool scale, or that helps. Also helps, the guidelines are also available for women with spinal cord injury. They can read them themselves or bring them to the appointment with a gynecologist or the urologist. So it helps as a tool and a quality standard.
It's good that the patients have them as well, I think, not just the doctors, so they can also learn and know their possibilities. Maria, what can you share your top advice on how to decrease the number of women with incontinence problems for the future? And I also would like to address the women that have incontinence problems today, and what can they do to feel better and have a better everyday life?
To start with the prophylactic advices. Yeah. I think there's not much you can do. You have your genetics, your hereditary factors, but of course, avoiding being overweight. It's especially bad for urinary and bowel incontinence. There's a lot of talking about prophylactic pelvic floor exercises, but that have actually not been shown being effective. And that's quite, I can understand that, because to motivate healthy people to do exercises to avoid incontinence is hard. But in spite that we don't have much science on pelvic floor exercises, it's always better to have more muscles than less muscles. And of course, the older you get, the less muscle you have. So I think training exercises, pelvic floor exercises, are actually good. And then, of course, we have maybe to work more with prediction modeling. For example, now we are having a prediction modeling of women risk, individualized risk for having a sphincter rupture. And we know a lot of things that, for example, the baby's size before a vagina birth is very important to know to avoid anal sphincter rupture. And I think that is extremely important for those who already got bowel problems and then prefer to do a cesarean section instead of try to do a vagina delivery. I think that would be... And of course, to avoid a forceps delivery, that is one of the most dangerous things for the pelvic floor. So that there are some obstetrics things that you really should avoid. And for the women who's already affected, I think it's important to seek help. And maybe, I know a lot of women, they try to talk to their general practitioners and they don't listen to them actually, or just don't refer them. To see a urogynecologist or a gynecologist and discuss what possibilities there are for urinary incontinence. We have a lot of good surgical or medical treatments today, and also genital prolapse. And as you're saying, we have a lot of conservative treatments for bowel incontinence, and we do have things to help out.
Yeah, I think, Maria, that is really interesting. I think especially in people with spinal cord injury, of course, taking care of your bladder and bowel is of utmost importance. Unfortunately, in the case of spinal cord injury, that's a daily task.
Yes.
So that's really an issue in which women should take care lifelong. But if I see the results of we developed a bowel outpatient appointment with nurses, with a dietitian, and with a medical doctor, And then still in about 80% of the people that were seen in this appointment, it was the basics. Drinking enough, regulating your stool, eating enough fibers, staying active, etc., etc. So I think in the conservative management, there is still also a little bit of room for optimization.
Yes. Yes, I think we actually could learn a lot of what you are doing. I think maybe you discuss this more on daily basis than we do, actually. But
yeah, we thought
we learn from each other.
Mm. When we did this special appointment, we thought that the solutions would be very complex and that we would discuss, for example, Malone, stoma, etc., etc. But in the majority of the patients, we saw that beginning at the basics, eating the right things, drinking enough, having your fibers, regulate your bowel management, which of course is different for every person depending on their level, their completeness, their lifestyle. But forgetting the basics is not a good idea. The solution is often in the basics. Yeah.
Yep. Basics are good.
And teamwork.
Yes. Teamwork. Teamwork and awareness.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, it is. We're actually approaching the end of this webinar, and I think I'll just try to summarize some of the discussions that we have today. And I think unfortunately, it's still very little progress made in the prevention of pelvic floor disorder for women, even though we know that these disorders cause significant economical impact on the society, and of course, suffering for so many women that deals with these challenges every day. And especially bowel problems, I would say. And so there's still so much that we can do for our women. On the other hand, there are preventative models that can be used before childbirth to identify women who are at risk. And Maria talked a bit about that. And we would like to make sure that we would share the links to these models after this call to make sure that those of you listening can interact and get to know a little bit about the preventive measures that's available. You will find them in our show notes afterwards. But I think perhaps the single most important conclusion of today is that it is the duty of the doctor and the nurse, not the patient, to ask questions around incontinence for women, to bring this area and topic to the floor. Because these issues need to be addressed and treated. And I think since there are so many women out there that are too embarrassed to talk about this, I think it's up to the healthcare professional to take this up upon their responsibilities and give them the help that they need to have. And bring that, as Inge said, into a structured conversation during the appointment. I think that is really a key in spreading the word. Is there anything you would like to add to that, Maria or Inge?
No, I agree. And I hope that if we have this webinar in 5 years, that speaking about bladder and bowel incontinence is just as normal as speaking about other health issues.
I hope you're right, Inge.
Yes, we're at least doing a try here with this webinar, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you so much. One of the topics, Amy, at the ASCOS meeting is female care.
Really?
And bowel management, yes.
I love that. I think I have
me
to come.
Too.
You should come as well, Maria.
Yes.
Yes. And for all you guys listening, I hope you enjoyed this webinar. You can watch the previous episodes on the ASCOS YouTube channel. I think they also have it on their ASCOS website. So there you can find more content to listen to. If you have any suggestions or questions afterwards, we would love to hear from you. And you will find the email address to ASCOS in the show notes afterwards. So please reach out to us if there is anything you'd like to ask. We'll make sure to answer those questions. ASCOS also like to take the opportunity to invite you all to their scientific annual meeting in Antwerpen in Belgium in October. I don't know, will you be coming in, Inge, you think?
I'm certainly there.
Yeah, let's hope so. I think it'll be a very interesting topics there that is being brought up. So please read more about that meeting on ASCOS webpage. There you'll find where you also can sign up. Finally, a really big thank you to Maria and Inge for sharing all this valuable research, experience and knowledge with all of us listening here. It's been so interesting and rewarding, and I hope we will meet soon again, as Inge said, and hopefully in a few years, this will be higher up on the agenda in most forums. And for you, the rest of you out there listening, I'd just like to thank you for listening today and looking forward in meeting you in another day. Thank you and have a good day.